Thank you very much, JP, for the invitation to be here, and I'm glad to have the chance to speak to everyone today. Maybe I should just mention a little bit and say that since the first two speakers had their own Phil Anderson stories, I'll mention that I have just a few brief interactions with Phil. When I was a graduate student, actually, the Santa Fe Institute ran a winter school, it turns out, and he was one of the lecturers. And he gave great lectures on the renormalization group at that winter school. I don't know what his students felt exactly, but this was like a two-week summer school or winter school, and there were a couple other lecturers. But after a while, this was back in the era of when people used transparencies, and his handwriting was not very legible. I don't know if people remember that about Phil, but and so after a while, I just decided to lay back and quit taking notes and just try to take in the meaning of what he was saying, and that was much more useful, I found. And then subsequently, JP also asked whether, wondered whether Phil stayed involved with SFI's economics program, and I'm a regular participant in that program over the years, and so I will just report that I learned a lot from Phil, but hopefully I gave a little bit back. It turns out that we had a big meeting on finance in the mid to late aughts, 2000s at Santa Fe, and I remember talking to him at one of the coffee breaks, and he was worried at the time that he had great growth in the equity part of his portfolio, and he was really wondering about the importance of rebalancing it. And I said, very important that you should go rebalance it, Phil. And it turns out about 6 months later there was a big collapse. So I think that hopefully I contributed to his portfolio a little bit. All right, so I'm going to talk today about the idea of multi-level systems, and I do mostly economics, but I do it also maybe from a computing point of view. So I'm going to try to illustrate this. I'm going to talk abstractly at the start, but then I'll illustrate my main comments. And I've tried to take seriously the idea that many people in the audience come from varied backgrounds, and so I'm going to have only kind of a thin veneer of formal argument here, or maybe mathematical argument. But I will be a bit of that in the beginning here. If I get these slides to advance, okay. So what I'm going to talk about primarily is going to be, in essence, the same system but at different levels of representation. So hopefully this fits into the previous talks a little bit, in the sense of building kind of condensed or simplified models. But what I want to get to eventually here is I'm going to transition. Hopefully I'll make a point of it in the middle of the talk. I'm going to transition from how we understand a system at multiple levels to how the system actually operates at multiple levels. And I'll make that distinction as I go forward. Okay, so imagine we've got some just dynamical system happening in some high dimensional space, n dimensional Euclidean space, say. But there's also representations of it in some other lower dimensional space. I'm going to call it kind of micro, meso, macro. And we have these aggregation operators that can kind of function to aggregate the micro states into the macro states. But I want to do this, I want to think about this at least initially as doing this exactly. Okay, so we're going to have an exact representation for this. And then I'm going to get into this business about downward causation. So I want to at least be a little bit formal about what I mean by emergence. And it's going to be a restricted sense of what emergence has meant, I think, given the earlier talks and JP's opening comments. In particular, I want to contrast properties at the different levels that might be considered resultant versus those that would be technically more like emergent. So imagine we think about equilibrium at several different levels here. For example, and once again, just apologize for just a little bit of mathematics, but imagine that we have the microscopic level is in equilibrium. It's in some kind of, there's no more change with time. So this kind of implies that this macro, as long as I built the aggregate variables up from the micro ones, that the aggregate one's going to be also in equilibrium. And it turns out that we can say this about other properties as well. That is, and I'm going to get to an example of this, but take my word for it for now, that basically the modes of the microscopic system, if they're all stable, for example, then the modes of this macroscopic thing are going to be stable too, okay? So one mental model here might be something like statistical mechanics, where you're going to have, not yet statistical mechanics. This is an example where I've got some dynamics happening, but then they die away, and at all levels the system is going to be stable and be in equilibrium. And to that, we can do this for other properties too, but I'm going to skip most of these and just say, for example, we can think about how does this whole system depend on some distinguished parameter, and so say it's insensitive to some parameter, then I can say this at multiple levels it's going to be. If the microsystem is not changing with respect to the parameter, then the macrosystem won't either. So these are kind of resultant properties, and it's normal in the philosophy of this kind of philosophy of emergence to distinguish resultant from emergence. I'm just trying to formalize that idea here. And the contrast is going to be now into the, you know, once again, the statistical mechanics, perhaps, analogy is the one I want to get to. Imagine that the macroscopic level is, in fact, in some, you know, unchanging state, and think, you know, it's temperature or something, right? But I can still have microscopic dynamics, of course, right? Now, it turns out that this is quite natural, I think, for a physicist to think about. But in economics, it is not natural, it turns out. In economics, we normally would think about the fact that I've got Nash equilibrium at the microscopic level, or I've got some notion of Walrasian or some other equilibrium concept. And so that's going to give me a macroscopic, that's going to cause the macroscopic dynamics to vanish. So the usual notions of equilibrium in economics are going to be much more like resultant properties, not this kind of emergent property that I'm talking about here. Now, this notion of emergence is not the one of novelty that JP talked about earlier with Anderson's work, but it's just maybe a more restricted notion, but it's going to be sufficient for my purposes here today. And it turns out that, the shorthand for this, this is that, you know, at the macroscopic level, I'm going to get some, or meso-macroscopic level, I can get the unchanging behavior to emerge, even though the microscopic level is going to be changing. And then to the stability, maybe one other point here to say that, right, I wrote this initially for the macro level, but I could also think about if y is this meso level, x is micro, y meso, x z macro. I could also think about it as being, it could be that the meso level is in equilibrium, which implies that the macroscopic one will be, but the micro one still can be out of equilibrium. In fact, the example I'm going to give in some detail is going to have this flavor, where we'll have at least three different levels working at once. Now, when it comes to other properties, I'll give a concrete example of this in a minute, is that we can think about something like, you know, where the stability at one level, does not imply, for example, it could be that macroscopically, the whole thing looks like it's stable, but underlying it, we could have very complex dynamics that have some, you know, maybe a more complicated, structure to the eigenvalues. And then going on to insensitivity, similar idea. The fact that I simply have macroscopic insensitivity does not imply anything about the market. So this is now, if we go back to kind of like, you know, undergraduate philosophy, these are just various statements of something that we might call, like, you know, the fallacies of division and composition, right? If I know the macroscopic level, I have only limited knowledge of the microscopic level, and vice versa. And I could say, extend this in various ways. But what I really want to do here, maybe the shorthand to say this one, is just the emergent parameter irrelevance at higher levels of abstraction. Okay. This is all just by way of background. I want to give a very concrete example, though, and hopefully this, once again, a little bit more mathematics, but hopefully this is going to be clear from in the very simplest case of having linear dynamics. And this is not my example. This is an old example from the engineering literature, it turns out. So imagine that we have this kind of microscopic structure happening in very high dimensional part of the Euclidean space, n-dimensional. But I have this very similar representation, so it's just going to be a system of linear differential equations in some smaller dimensional space, m dimensional, but it could be much smaller, in fact. And I've got some way to represent these, a way to aggregate the microscopic world x up into the macroscopic world y. Okay, so this is, I've just built these macroscopic states. And so it turns out that, you know, with a bit of substitution here, and I've skipped the details, but if I just, you know, if I say that, you know, y is a of x, but I know that that the dynamics are going like this, it turns out that I'm going to get these two systems to agree exactly if I have ga equals af, and these are just two, you know, some matrices here that I need to make agree. Now, if in fact I know the f exactly, so let's say I really know the microscopic world exactly, I want to basically build up this aggregation matrix A, form this, and then have the aggregate dynamics be given by G. So in some sense, I can choose those. Okay, given F, I can choose G and A. And now, how do I do that? What's the best way to do that? Now, it turns out I'm going to just do a very brief digression on this. This is an astonishingly simple looking equation. It seems like it should be well understood. Remember, it's a rectangular system because m and n are not equal here. But so just a very brief digression on this, because I think it's interesting to think about it. So here's the digression on this matrix equation. And it turns out that, for g is lower dimensional than f. F is higher dimensional, n by n. And then a is the mapping between these two matrices. If you open up the Gantmacher from the two volumes set on linear systems, it turns out that right, the only way that this system can make sense, the only way to really solve this, is I have to have G's got to hold some subset of the modes of F. Okay, I basically can't invent new eigenvectors, eigenvalues for G. I have to basically use some of the eigenvalues that are in F. And then, if you look at this thing, if G is just a diagonal vector, a diagonal matrix holding the holding some of the eigenvalues of F, then basically A is just going to be the matrix that's going to have M left eigenvectors of F. Okay, so if I do all this, if I just if I specify A and G that way, I'm going to get a valid representation at a different level. Now, there's more to say about this. I'm not going to say a lot more about it, but the thing that's that I would also like to be comment on is the fact that I'm basically creating then, if I have A is going to be these eigenvectors, then I'm going to basically be creating the aggregate states that are weighted. I'm going to basically be producing the Y's that are weighted based on the eigenvectors, and I may want to do that. I may not want to do that. That may preserve symmetry or break symmetry. That may preserve I may be able to still conserve things that I want to conserve. Yes or no? If it's physics, maybe I conserve energy. Yes or no? If it's economy, maybe I conserve the amount of money. Yes or no? But anyways, but the main thing to say is that I can think about the fact that if in fact the microscopic world is again in equilibrium, I get that the macroscopic one is. And I can also get this business about the sensitive dependence or dependence on a distinguished parameter. That all goes through because if the microscopic world vanishes, the macroscopic world is going to vanish. Okay, so that's all fine. But I can also talk about emergent steady states, even in this linear world, because when I think about what it means to be a steady state in the macroscopic world, right? If I have the macroscopic world has no dynamics, well, it turns out that I can get that this way. And every vector x star, which is in the null space of A, is going to still leave me in an equilibrium here. So basically, I can have some kind of dynamics at the microscopic level. This is unchanging, but this could be a function of time. And so I can have microscopic dynamics arising here naturally, even in this linear world, having the dynamical states part of the null space of this rectangular operator A. And then I can also do the same thing for emergent sensitivity here. I mean, it's the same idea. As long as the vectors I'm playing with are in the null space, then everything goes forward. Okay, so this is all just by way of background, and say this is the way we might think about micro, meso, macro in terms of how we as scientists would describe it. But now I want to change course a little bit, change gears, and say I'm no longer interested in how we describe it. I'm less interested in that, say. What I really care about is how does the darn thing work? How does the system operate? And in particular, is it ever the case that, in fact, the microscopic states might depend in some structural way on the macroscopic ones? Okay? That is, the microscopic states give rise to the macroscopic, and then there's some way in which these macroscopic things will feed down back into the microscopic. Now, you probably all have mental models of systems where this is obviously true. But it turns out that in the philosophy of how this might work, there's lots of debate about this. Okay, so what I've written here is that so far we know how the meso arises from the micro, and we can talk about how the macro Z arises from the meso Y. And then this dependence is kind of right. It's always going upwards. We're always going from micro. We believe we're all reductionist in principle. We all believe the reductionist world, and the micro world is going to arise. The micro world is somehow the macro world is somehow epiphenomenal. It's just built up from the micro. The micro is the real world, right? And we think of the macro as being just a reduced form representation. It's kind of what we see, maybe. It's what we have some sensor, some measurement device, which only picks up the macro world. But the micro world is where all the action is. So the usual terminology you might say is that the only way I could ever get a change in the meso world. Or a change in, would be to have a change in the micro world. This would be the terminology of supervenience. If you've never heard that term before, it's probably not helpful. If you haven't heard it before, it's how I'm going to use it here. If I'm going to change Y, I'm going to have to change X. That's all it really means. But now what I've started to get to a minute ago is, what if in fact, though, the underlying dynamics depend on some aggregate variable? Aggregate variable, which at first we thought was only how we think about the system, but now I want to say it really is part of the system. And that is, I've written here now, you know, could be one version of this is that these underlying dynamics I could also write in this way. Maybe this is one way to think about it. So it turns out that philosophers, and I'm thinking about Paul Humphreys at Virginia or Kim at Brown, have raised this argument against the idea that in fact these aggregate variables could ever have any meaning microscopically, that is that they could feed back and cause changes downwardly, for the argument based on the assertion that basically they say, well, why do I don't really need the y, right? Y is just formed from the x, so I don't need the y. The y's are just kind of superfluous. So in fact, there's no way in which you could have downward causation. It's just extraneous somehow. It's like an extra variable that just arises, but it's epiphenomenal somehow. But one very practical reason why I may care about having y in the system is that it could just be easier for me. So I'm gonna analyze the system. It might be easier just to keep y in mind, and then I can do analysis better. But then I'm even going to give a third argument here, and this is the one that I'm going to basically try to claim with you all and see if you buy the argument. Once again, I think many people have experience with such systems, and you're not going to worry about the philosopher's arguments contrary here. But basically, if in fact y is some kind of emergent, then in fact it might have different properties than the x. And the simplest one, say, would be equilibrium, for example. Maybe y is equilibrium, and the x has complex dynamics. So I don't want to have to deal with computing some kind of microfine structure of the dynamics because y is actually already in steady state of some kind. So it may just be that it has value as a meaningful variable or set of variables that I want to play with. And so here are just some examples. Now I've written question mark on here just because maybe you will find these as good examples of what I've just described or not. And once again, the classic case of this would be some kind of statistical mechanics argument. Right, I know I've got the gas in a container, I know PVT. What if I exogenously decrease the volume, but I do it slowly at a constant temperature, say, I cause the pressure to rise. So basically, now, when I compress the gas, right, I'm modifying the molecular velocity distribution. I'm changing right, the constant in the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution or whatever. So it turns out you may or may not view this as being a kind of a downward causation. Now it turns out the system is not making downward causation, it's me as the experimenter doing this, and I'm not going to spend a lot more time on this because it turns out that in the philosophy of science, among these philosophers of science, this is actually the canonical example they talk about, or one of the canonical examples. They will talk about whether this is an example of downward causation or not. So I'm going to go into examples that I think are more salient, but we can come back and talk about this one if you wish. But for an economy, for example, let's say that I'm an economic actor, you're an economic actor, your firm is an economic actor, but your actions are going to depend on what the interest rate is, R. Now, the interest rate is actually something that's kind of posted at the level of, if not at the level of the central bank, it's at least posted at the level of the local bank you're trying to borrow from. And so this is, in some sense, a higher level variable because this interest rate, R in the sense of Piketty, I suppose, I've given that symbol here. If in fact R is somehow some composite of what's going on in the rest of the economy, right? R can be either high or low, and we all know it's been very low lately. The economy, what the economy does matters. So in some sense, this R variable, that's some kind of meso level, but it still affects the behavior of the individuals in the economy. So it's kind of an obvious example, it seems to me, of this kind of downward causation. And the bank rate depends on what's happened elsewhere. I'm going to give a different example, though, in detail. I'm going to talk about, in the time that I have, a model in which it's going to seem, I think, quite natural to say that, the organization in which you're in depends on your performance to some extent, but then the way in which the organizational performance depends will then alter the kinds of opportunities that are available to future agents, or even to you, potentially, within that organization. So there's some kind of right, flow from micro, your activity, up to the macro of the organization, but then that flows back, and I'm going to give an example of that here in a second. I think we can also talk about, we had some discussion this morning already about neuroscience, et cetera. We can come back to maybe interpretation of the mind-body problem in this context, but for now, I'm not going to belabor that. Okay, so it turns out that, and this is just a little bit of a deflection for those who are social scientists, which I think is not most people, but it's that in sociology in particular, we do have this idea of for a generation of what's called Coleman's boat, And Coleman's boat is the following assertion. Coleman says, look, the real world is in some state, the real social world is in some state X, which is complicated. I don't really understand it. I don't have all the information. I don't know all the details. But I have some aggregation operator to use my previous notation. And now I do have some data about what the social world looks like today. So today in Paris in 2022, we know these things are going on. The markets are doing this. The war is doing that, et cetera, et cetera. We have some representation of this. And Coleman says, I want to get to here. What's the world going to be like tomorrow or in a month or in a year? Okay. Our goal is to get from Y at T to Y at T plus one. We want to understand how the world evolves. And Coleman essentially asserts that G is either very hard to come by or impossible. We don't know how to build that representation. We don't know how to aggregate states appropriately. So he says, the only way to get from Y at T to Y at T plus one is to go down to the micro level, increment by one unit of time over here, and then go up. And that's the black line. And given that it has the shape of a boat hull, it's known as Coleman's boat, okay? But in essence, it's a denial of the fact that you can, A, that you can go this way, that we don't have enough understanding of what the G is. Now, we'd like to maybe build that up, and people who do macroeconomics do this for a living, right? But it's also tied with this assertion that you have to go down and around, and it's either not saying anything about this downward causation thing, or it's denying it, right? By saying, look, the macro thing is not of interest in affecting the micro. The directionality is all one way. The micro world really determines the micro world for all future states. All right. So at this point, I want to go into an example, which I think, hopefully, after I've shown you the example, is going to, you know, you'll come away thinking that this is not right, because there really is going to be feedback from this macroscopic level down to the microscopic level. And my extended example is going to basically be, demonstrate for you a model in which individual agents form firms. These firms evolve, and then the individuals are going to pursue things that are going to pursue payoffs, welfare, utility for themselves as they interact. Now, when you're in one of these groups or firms or teams, when you're in your organization in real life, right, your payoff depends to some extent on what's going on with the rest of your teammates, right? I mean, you have good teammates or poor teammates. Your company has had a good quarter or a bad quarter, whatever it is. It may be the case that some of the people in your team are going to migrate to different teams if, in fact, your team is not doing well, for example. So we can imagine the teams are going to be in perpetual flux, even though the total number of teams will ebb and flow with entry and exit into an economy. Say, think about the private sector as a simple example. Firms come and go all the time. Okay, so it turns out, once again, in the previous slide was in the spirit of not trying to, or trying to, show the overview of what's going on here. There is some mathematics behind this. Now, let me just run through this very quickly for those of you who want to see this. This is the model I'm going to describe is a kind of a classic one in economics. It's called the labor-leisure trade-off model. We imagine every individual can contribute some amount of effort to their team. Their team consists of N agents, and so the total effort in the team is just the sum of that. But we're going to build in the fact that there's going to be increasing returns to scale. That is, this effort level is going to go up in some way that the output of the firm, output of the group, is a superlinear function of the input. So this is just the idea that, you know, a team of people can do more than the individuals can accomplish on their own, and it's usually interpreted that way. But now when it comes to sharing the output, we're going to have some rule, and alpha here is just a parameter which can divide this output up in some way. If alpha is one, we're going to basically reward people in proportion to how much effort they put in. For those of you who are maybe natural scientists, E sub not I is just the effort level contributed by everybody else. So this is the total of these things is just the capital E. If alpha is zero, notice we just get equal shares independently of how hard you work. And then it turns out that if I write down, this is going to be a standard representation of a utility function. Agents like the income they get from working. They also like not working. They also like leisure, which is everything you didn't contribute in effort terms. The theta determines how heterogeneous agents are. Agents with high theta love income. Agents with low theta love leisure, a standard model. In the model I'm going to show you, in the instance I'm going to show you, we'll have thetas of all different types. We'll have income lovers and leisure lovers both. Okay, so, one key thing you'll see when I run this model, demonstrate the model, is that agents are going to change their team as they seek higher and higher levels of utility. I think I'm going to skip this slide just in the interest of time, and I can come back to it. This is just a two-agent version of the thing, and it turns out in this team production game, where effort level of agent one is on this axis, effort level of agent two on this level, we get a Nash equilibrium level, and it turns out that departs from the Pareto surface, which is the Pareto optimal level, simply because we have the increase in returns to scale. Basically, agents will under-supply effort at equilibrium, but we'll see what that means here in a second when I run this model. Okay, so this is the simple version of, I'm going to talk through this and then show you a live representation. Here are five firms, A through E, consisting of 13 agents, and at time T. And now let's imagine that they're going to march forward in the next time. Agent number 6 is going to leave team B and go to team A. Agent number 10 is going to leave team C. Agent number 9 is going to leave C also, but and go out and do a startup firm. Agent number 11 is going to shut down firm D and join firm E. So at time T, we get this. Okay, so if this is just whatever the incentives were, the agents did this. But now I want to imagine doing this at a larger scale. I'm going to show you an example now for, I think, 500 or 1,000 agents doing this. But understand now that we can build models of this type now for an entire economy. And it turns out that given data on the microscopic structure of, for example, the American private sector, which are data that I have available to me, I can build models with the 120 million interacting agents who form 6 million firms, and we can then make that model look very much like the real U.S. private sector. But instead of showing you that giant model, I'm just going to show you a simpler one. Say this has got, it says 1,000 agents, but I actually think it's 500 agents. I'm here. So, okay, what every little this model's running, every little horizontal line is just a team, okay? And the red agent is the agent with the most seniority and is deciding who to hire and who to get rid of in the team, but many agents will just leave on their own. And what you're seeing is this kind of, a lot of flux here. That is, at the microscopic level, there are people who are going to, join a team, but maybe they're going to leave a team. When a whole forms in a team, you're going to see that's when somebody has left the team. You'll see firms grow, these little groups, I'm going to call them firms, just groups. These little groups are going to form. You'll see some big ones, but look, they're mostly little ones, right? Size 1, size 1, 2, where my cursor is, where the mouse is, 1, another size 5, 6, but 2, 1, 1. It turns out that, and this is also true in France, the modal firm size in France is 1, a firm with 1 employee. The average is around size 15 or something, but there are firms that are quite large with hundreds of thousands of employees. But there's a power law of there's a few large firms, there's progressively larger numbers of progressively smaller firms. This model can capture that. And although this is not the calibrated model, the main reason I'm showing it to you though is to get the idea across clearly that when an agent decides to leave what was previously a growing firm and move somewhere else, it is basing that decision on what is going on in its firm. So this is 1,000 or I think it's actually 500 agents. And the way it actually works is every instant in time, all 500 are taking a decision about where would they be better off. Should they stay in the current firm? Should they work hard, work less? Or should they join a different firm? And it's going to be clear from what's going on here is that whether any individual agent is going to stay in their group, yes or no, is of course dependent on what else is going on in that group. And so of course there's downward causation in almost a trivial fashion here from this. Now this is kind of the meso level, right? You're seeing the individual level, the microscopic level are the individual dots. The meso level are the individual teams. And then the population level, the macro level, is going to be the population of all the teams, which here is kind of trivial. It's only going to be a few hundred of them. But in the in the large model of the U.S. economy, there's 6 million firms that run. By the way, just as a footnote, why is this happening? And it turns out if you look here closely, the average effort level in the whole population is 0.29 here at time 21. But in the big firm, because of the increase in returns to scale, the average effort level in the biggest firm is much lower. And so basically, agents find it okay to shirk in the big firms. You can put in a little less effort in the bigger. Your firm is so productive, you can put in a little less effort. But then once a firm becomes overtaken by shirkers, then in fact the people who love income are going to leave and go make a new firm or something. Okay, so this is just a background. This is a simple model in which we have this kind of downward causation obviously happening. And so I've already said most of this, I think. The firms form because of increasing returns. They undersupply effort, and we get shirking happening. Average effort in large firms is less than in the smaller firms, but we still get things that look realistic the way these firms work. New firms founded by agents with high income preferences, but here's the key, I think, from the downward causation point of view. The opportunities that are available to agents depend very much on what's happening at this mesoscale, what's happening at the level of the individual firms. So now notice, this is now no longer a model in which the mesoscale is simply, I'm writing it down to understand how the thing works. The mesoscale is realistically arising here to look like the real economy, in fact. So the shorthand firms, as agents, for example, alter cause the individual agent states alter the behavior. Okay, so I've written here now of the revised version of Coleman's boat, that is to say that at the level of individual workers who create firms, what's happening at this meso level, at the level of firms, downward causes what can happen at the microscopic level. It seems quite obvious. I think that trying to get now my philosopher friends to not worry about this so much, that we have, downward causation is quite real in this sense. Okay, this model now leaves out many things. It's not a model with deep economic content in what I've shown you, but this can all be added in, and we've done this, and I'm just going to skip that for now. So this is just to avoid the question of, the model is not very realistic. But it turns out we make the model, we use about a dozen parameters here. We can make this model agree with about three dozen facts about the real U.S. economy. So I'm going to skip that and just get onto the summary and leave time for questions here. So the quick summary is that, when we have a social system with individuals and then some meso-macro level, these are always going to be multi-level systems. And this kind of computational model that I've just shown you, where we have the behaviors of the individual, you can think about them as particles, but we think about them, we use the word agent, and we think about them as people. The individual social systems are always multi-level systems, could be more than just micro-macro, could also be three. Emergence can happen, at least in the case of having kind of microdynamics and macroscopic stationarity, maybe also in the way of creating novel properties, but I'm not focused on that here. This downward causation is quite real, and we can see it in action in this class of agent-based models that I've discussed. I think in particular, when the things that arise at the meso or macro scale are emergent, then in fact we have heterogeneous things, right? We have a lot of heterogeneous emergent things arising. When we have this heterogeneity present in particular, then in fact the way the feedback goes from this meso or macro level down to the micro level is decisive, in the sense that it's going to really change the way the whole system behaves. And it turns out that, my last bullet, I'm going to use a word I have not used until now. It turns out in economics, everyone knows that institutions are important. Institutions would be things that are brick and mortar, like, the Central Bank of Italy, or the Bank of England, or the Federal Reserve Board in the U.S. It could also be things like just social norms. That is, it is normal to behave in such and such a way. It is normal to not send your paper to two journals at the same time, whatever. There are institutions that arise at the meso level. Now, it turns out that most conventional mathematical economics does some violence to these institutions in the sense that we either neglect them, we don't represent them at all. In macroeconomics, we have very parsimonious or non-existent representation of central bank behavior, for example. Or when we do put them in, we put them in some way that may be not totally satisfactory. For example, in reality, the world is full of regulatory institutions, NGOs, for example, that try to make the world a better place. Think about the OECD. Think about quasi-government institutions. Even think about governance as an institution, right? So when we want to build these things in, but now think about, the most well-known model in economics is what's called general equilibrium model, where we simply say there are individual actors with preferences, and under certain special conditions on their preferences, we can solve for what is the market clearing price. That's a model of how markets work, but there are no regulators in the market, there are no institutions, there are no order books, a whole variety of real institutional features are not there. So I think that the way that we can make progress, though, to model these institutions is think about them as in this meso level. And then it's natural to think about, in fact, the institutions can then feed back down to what's going to happen at the agent level, either to coordinate people or maybe even to uncoordinate people if in certain contexts. So this is, I think, this is the main take-home message, is that we need to do a better job with modeling these institutions in the social sciences. It's always been hard to do that mathematically. With the rise of mathematical economics after World War II, we've not done due diligence to this always. And I think, though, that the ability to represent these kinds of things, or even have them arise spontaneously in our computational model specifically, is a kind of more is different. And I'll stop here, and we have time for questions, I think.